Hey everybody, this is Jay from The Lost Podcast with Jay and Jack, Ramblecast, and more. I'm here to tell you are going to listen to a special excerpt from our recent 2015 podcast charity for Autism Speaks podcast-a-thon. We podcasted 12 hours in a row, and over the next couple weeks, we will be revealing and unveiling and releasing different portions from this 12-hour telethon. It was a lot of fun. Thank you for everybody that participated. Thank you for everybody that came out. And thank you for all of those that donated to Autism Speaks, a fantastic charity that we've been doing this podcast-a-thon for many years. So you can still donate. You still have a chance to donate. You can do that until the end of April. You can donate over PayPal through lpdonate@gmail.com. So that's lpdonate@gmail.com. Send it as a friends or family and or as a gift. And then you can also mail a check to 2601 North Raleigh Boulevard, Raleigh, North Carolina, 27604, care of Jay and Jack, payable to Autism Speaks. Just everything, every penny goes directly to Autism Speaks. So, again, lpdonate@gmail.com, and that address I just said, go there to donate. You have till the end of April. And now, let's take it away for one of the fantastic clips from this weekend.
Hello?
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 Dr. Jeffrey Jensen?
Hi, Jeff.
Is that what we're going with?
Dr. Jeffrey Jensen, that's right. Jeff, hello, thank you, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Woo! Doing well. We're in hour two of our podcast.
Already fallen asleep.
And Jack already fell asleep, so it's been really good so far. But thank you for coming on. Really great to talk to you.
I think the last time I did this with you guys a few years ago or several years ago, I was getting you after a sleepless night and you were delightfully punchy.
Yeah, you're getting us pretty fresh this time. So
so the pressure's on for us to be.
Yeah, there's no excuse for us to be horrible this time.
I doubt you will be.
How's it going, man? It's been a long time.
Yeah. Things have been pretty busy. You know, things have been pretty full, and exciting times and for me with this movie Tomorrowland coming out, and so that's exciting.
It is. So was it just released the book before Tomorrowland? I was reading it or trying to read as much as I could up to the show this week. But you co-wrote that book, correct?
That's right. We did a prequel novel, basically. I wrote it with Jonathan Case, the artist who worked with me on my graphic novel about my dad, and we wrote it. Jonathan did a lot of the heavy lifting, working from a story that I kind of conceived during the brainstorming days of working with Damon and Brad Bird on the story for Tomorrowland. And we came up with all of this, you know, backstory for our movie. Only a little bit, you know, is relevant to the movie and a little bit that we use, but we came up with all these great ideas for stories before our story. And we thought it'd be really cool to get one of those out there and kind of give, you know, some people some idea of this world that we made. So we, you know, my job was to turn it into a novel, and that came out on Tuesday, and it's called Before Tomorrowland.
That's awesome. That's real awesome. Yeah. So far, I mean, I think I made it to chapter four right now. And it seems like there's just different stories, and are they going to kind of all coalesce together, or is it just kind of showing you?
Yeah, absolutely. Like the story kind of toggles pretty evenly between. Like three different stories. It's set over the 4th of July weekend of 1939. So you have the World's Fair going on in New York City. It's in New York July 4th, 1939. So you have the World's Fair, which was this huge, amazing exhibition devoted to imagining the world of the future. You had the first World Science Fiction Convention. The first what we now call Worldcon, and this was a major flashpoint for fandom. There had been, you know, science fiction fandom was a slowly developing concern, and the movers and shakers of fandom at that time decided to make this weekend, against the backdrop of the World's Fair, a big coming out party for science fiction fandom. And it was also the weekend, of course, that Lou Gehrig retired officially from baseball and gave his famous speech in Yankee Stadium about feeling like he's the luckiest guy on the face of the world. So against this backdrop, we kind of tell the story about these two people, Clara Brackett and Lee Brackett. Clara is this artist, and she's Lee's mom, and she's come to New York City to go to the science fiction convention. She's sort of a geek before geek was cool. And she's an artist, and she wants to show her portfolio to the science fiction editors there in hopes of getting some business for herself. And her son Lee is a baseball fan, and he doesn't really go in for this geek stuff. But she's enticed him to go with the promise of going to the baseball game. Mm-hmm. And they have a very special relationship because Clara has cancer, and Lee has been taking very care of her during this time. Dad's kind of a traveling salesman and never home. And so they go to this convention, and they get caught up in a crazy adventure that's been hatched by the secret society that you will come to get to know a little bit about in the movie Tomorrowland, the secret society that of geniuses and inventors and engineers and artists who have been in the movie, you will learn is are building this amazing city of the future. Mm-hmm. So back in 1939, they were up to some other things, and they have some big plans for the world and a big secret to share. And they're using both the World's Fair and the science fiction convention as a staging area for sort of like introducing this idea to the world. And so Clara and Lee get involved with an adventure. And of course, there's some bad guys. We got some Nazis. We got some mad scientists. And we have a rampaging out of control robot. And all of these different storylines kind of meet together, and ultimately, so yes, as you're reading it now, you're getting a chapter on each of our characters, including Amelia Earhart, who's this great action heroine in our story, and they all have these separate little storylines, but they all converge about halfway through the book. Yeah,
that's awesome. Okay. That's cool, because I really the prologue kind of brought me in, just kind of going to. Taking the kids, and they wanted to just do this, and they went to this kind of exhibition, and then he went on this kind of spherical ride or some sort. But just the imagination that just seems to be kind of pouring throughout of all of it, it was really engaging right away. And it seems like all the stories that I've gone through so far are also really exciting. And also it has a bit of a Indiana Jones feel to me too. But it feels like a really fun adventure.
Cool. Yeah, I think we're pretty proud of it. I think you'll find some of our characters more engaging than others. Some more moving and some a little more preposterous than others. But I hope you guys like it, and I think it comes together in a cool way. It's if you've read my Lost recaps over the years, I tend to err on the side of density. So it's a mythically dense little book. But I hope that people get a kick out of it.
Yeah, I think they will. And I think it has me excited for what this movie can be. Because I remember when they first talked about it, and I think I first heard about it when we were talking to Damon for one of these shows a few years ago, I think is when I first heard it brought up. But it's an exciting concept. How it doesn't seem like it ties too directly to, I guess you could say, maybe the source material, the Tomorrowland at Disneyland. Does it tie into that at all? Or is it just almost the idea of what Disneyland's Tomorrowland was, which was kind of a World's Fair continuing and existing and kind of always going World's Fair for the future?
What you just said, the second part of that, exactly. You know, this is not like, say, Pirates of the Caribbean. which, by the way, is my favorite theme park ride ever. But Pirates of the Caribbean, like, when you go on that ride, it tells you a story, you know? In many ways, the filmmakers who adapted that, quote unquote, into a movie franchise, I mean, they introduced character names, and Johnny Depp, of course, developed that great classic character. But, you know, it's a very narrative based ride and gives you a lot of elements to adapt. It gives you a story. Tomorrowland, is not that kind of quote unquote theme park adaptation. Mm-hmm. We're really working with the name and everything that meant to Walt Disney. Tomorrowland sort of is encoded with this sort of like Walt Disney sort of like philosophy about the future. He was an optimist, but he very much believed in, he was an optimist and he was a progressive, and he kind of believed in technology as a sort of like, and he believed in imagination as solutions for the world's problems. Mm-hmm. And believed in, you know, we were very much inspired by Walt's original conception of what Epcot was going to be.
Yeah.
Epcot stands for, you know, the experimental prototypes community of tomorrow. And he envisioned that as a real sort of living laboratory, a city of the future, but that was always constantly changing and evolving, that was staffed by an ever-changing roster of inventors and industrialists, engineers and average ordinary people and artists who were coming up with ideas that could help the world and that could be taken out to the world. It could be a place that in and of itself was an inspiration for the world, but within that place, ideas were being created that can also help the world. So we kind of wondered, you know, Epcot evolved and turned into something different. But we kind of wondered, wouldn't it be cool if, like, Walt really built that kind of city out there in its mm-hmm. most fantastic, like, cool, futuristic form? And then we started asking questions like, well, where would that place be? And who would get to go? And if it did exist, then why don't we know about it? And all of those questions kind of, like, suggested an idea for a story. And from there, we were kind of off and running, and it allowed us to create a story which allowed us to reflect on ideas about the future and how the future, our ideas have changed over the past 50 years, where we've gone from this sort of idea that the future is something that we make, and that's sort of like a fundamentally optimistic orientation, to a more kind of pessimistic orientation, where the future is going to happen to us, mm-hmm. and it's probably not going to be good. So the movie kind of asks a question about whether or not, like, if there's something about our older conceptions of the future and can be retrieved and are relevant today, or are they kind of antiquated? And we turn all of that, we take all of that high-minded thematic stuff that I just laid on you, and we turn it into like a really cool mystery adventure road trip story.
That's awesome. How did this kind of movie come about? Because it seems like, just outside looking in, that kind of utilizing this idea that everybody, or I mean, most people know about Disneyland and know about what that is. Was that kind of an easy way to sell it to the studio to then be able to make this kind of picture? Because it seems like today, you know, everything's a, you know, not comic book movies, but it's like a comic book movie or a sequel of a sequel. Was this like a chance to kind of utilize that brand, that Disney brand, to make a movie that might not be able to be made without that type of, you know, Disney recognition?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think you raise a really good point. I mean, it is very difficult these days to, you know, unless you're like a Christopher Nolan,
yeah,
and you are a sort of brand name filmmaker, and you can push through original ideas like Interstellar or Inception, that of course are going to attract huge bankable movie stars like, you know, Matthew McConaughey or Leonardo DiCaprio. Unless you're a Nolan, unless you're a Tim, well, not even Tim Burton, but I was a, you know, Steven Spielberg, you know, it's just kind of really hard to get like a big original idea going in the studio system these days. And I think it just kind of speaks to several things. Because I think that you know, I think Disney is looking for, I think they're very interested in working with very cool filmmakers to do original things. Mm-hmm. I am not the cool filmmaker in that equation. Brad Bird and Damon Lindelof are the cool filmmakers in that equation. And I think it, you know, it speaks really well of Disney that, you know, they want to make movies with those guys. And they're interested in the story they have to tell. And I'm not just kind of blowing smoke. I mean, like I was there at Ground Zero when, you know, after Lost was over, you know, like Damon, you know, Disney wanted to work with Damon. They were really interested in what kind of ideas for movies that he wanted to do. And so he, you know, they talked for a long time before I ever entered into the picture, and talked about the kinds of, you know, movies that are not being made right now, and kinds of themes that Damon would be interested in. And Damon was really interested in the ideas of future and the future and futurism. And he loved how that theme played out within the Walt Disney Company and the idea of Tomorrowland. Mm-hmm. And so from there, they just kind of said, tell us, Damon, develop a story for us that like expresses these things. And, I got on board to help them research kind of like futurism and science fiction stuff and the history of the Walt Disney Company. That led to us breaking a story, and that led to us kind of bringing Brad Bird involved. Damon was working with Brad in some capacity on Mission Impossible 3. Damon kind of lent some story and editing assistance to Brad toward the end of Mission Impossible 3. So that's how they... or is it number four? Ghost Protocol.
Yeah, Bird directed four. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they got to know each other, and Damon was telling him about this story that we were picking up. And Brad has a long history with Disney, and he's a Disney file, but he's very interested in themes of futurism too. Like, and I remember when we were even before Brad entered the picture, you guys have seen The Iron Giant, right?
Iron Giant is one of my favorite films of all time. That's where I will follow Brad Bird to the ends of the earth because of that movie.
Yeah. Hang on for a second. My son is coming crying.
Oh, it's all right. I'm a 10-month-old myself.
Hang on for a second. Sorry, guys.
It's fine. It's fine. No, I think he's nice.
You can have one vitamin. He wants a vitamin. He hasn't had his vitamins yesterday.
It's live. This is what happens. It's good. It's all good.
It's good podcast.
This is the peril of like doing interviews on Saturday when you're working with your kids. But you know, like I loved The Iron Giant, and we loved The Iron Giant. And you know that scene at the end where the blown apart robot is like is finding its parts from all over the world and coming back together again at the end. I've just spoiled the ending of Iron Giant for everyone. You know that part?
Spoiler.
Listen, yes, I know the part. And plus, the movie's been around for a while. Yeah. If you haven't seen it, it's your fault.
You know someone's mad. You know someone's mad, though.
Well, I remember talking to Damon. I was like the spirit of Tomorrowland for me is that scene for 120 minutes of a beautiful idea being recombined into something new and better and glorious. And so to now have Brad Bird directing the film and then really entering into the story process. And, you know, he's a writer on the film. He co-wrote the scripts with Damon that got this movie greenlit and made. To watch Brad turn this into a Brad Bird movie is pretty thrilling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool. That's really cool. And, you know, the thing that I love what Brad Bird's been able to do is go to live action, you know, because it just The Incredibles, Iron Giant, you know, some of the, again, I would put Iron Giant, you know, the top five animated movies arguably of all times. It was a fantastic film, and being able to go and Mission Impossible, was it Ghost Protocol, was that the fourth one? That was a fantastic action movie. Fantastic action movie. So I'm excited to see kind of where it goes with Tomorrowland and kind of see the kind of Brad Bird as a director. And of course, we're already bought into Damon and his writing and his ideas. So it kind of goes without saying, but excited about the Brad Bird element that gets put with that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it was just a really awesome experience to just, first and foremost, just be able to sit in that room them and kind of experience that creative energy and a little bit of like, what am I doing here? kind of feeling. But they're really great guys and huge imaginations. And it was pretty thrilling to watch them work together and kind of bring this and you know, to kind of take the story that we were kind of building and then really hone it and then really supercharge it and then, and bring it home. That was pretty awesome.
Yeah. And especially something like, that's kind of tapping into that vision that Disney, you look back on it now and it's really the will of Disney is what kind of put everything together, you know, the theme parks, the films, everything. And I can't think of, you know, two better people to kind of continue that vision in this film. So it's pretty cool. It's really, really cool. When does it come out? When does Tomorrowland come out? I have a 10-month-old now, so I don't know when any movie comes out, but I know it's coming out this summer, right?
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Tomorrowland comes out May 22nd, Memorial Day weekend.
All right. And it has George Clooney, our personal friend, close friend, yes. George Clooney.
I'm sorry?
No, not really.
It's our joke, our close personal friend, George Clooney.
What was it? Did you get to meet George Clooney at all? Like, is he as handsome in person as he is on the television and the screen?
Well, listen, if George and I were to pass on the street, my guess is that George would not look twice at me. which is kind of weird because in my times at Entertainment Weekly, before I wrote about television, I wrote mostly about movies and I interviewed him several times. And then on the set, yes, there were two times where I was on the set and got to, you know, hang out with George. And yes, that was very cool.
You go, oh my God, it's George Clooney.
My guess is that George Clooney meets probably like 50 new people every day. So, I would be, and that's probably like just when he's working. So, no, George and I are not best buds. I'm
that's
sorry.
All right. That's okay.
But listen to
we're good you're closer friends with him than we are, so it's good because we've never met him.
I watched ER.
I watched ER. I paid
actually,
for Batman and Robin. That should count for something.
I watched Facts of Life when he was on. So
well, there you go.
And Roseanne, right? Roseanne.
You know, it's been an interesting year with kind of the 10th anniversary of Lost. We kind of restarted our podcast. We're kind of looking back on it 10 years later, and we're re-releasing old episodes and stuff like that. And it's interesting. It's been 10 years since the show came out. What has kind of been your perspective, kind of looking back on the show 10 years later?
Well, I have as much affection for Lost now as I've ever had. I think when I think about Lost, I think a way of engaging television that is both pretty intense and pretty awesome, but also maybe a little unhealthy for me. I was pretty deep into that. I think about a show which, like, you know, we've had cultural phenomenons since Lost, you know, everything from, you know, the protracted period of, say, Game of Thrones and Walking Dead that we currently are in, or the finales of, say, Breaking Bad, or even the very kind of intense ride that was True Detective.
Yeah.
But in terms of kind of like these broadcast television pop culture phenomenons, Lost might have been, I don't know, we haven't seen anything since. And you know, like, I never say never, but you kind of wonder if that is sort of like, in terms of a broadcast television and what it represents, if that was sort of the peak pop phenomenon there for us. I look back on Lost. I think about that crazy story and how that unfolded for 6 years. I think about the amazing scope of themes and characters and ideas that they were able to put in there, and how much of myself, how much of it kind of supercharged my imagination. Mm-hmm. And it's just so awesome. Like I don't really know. Yeah, it's. I wish we had another Lost, but a different kind of Lost. I'm not talking about a show that of this genre.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of a story that can, really galvanize me. I think Mad Men scratched that itch. I've been a huge Mad Men fan. And I was really deep into True Detective. I think that probably those 8 episodes of True Detective is as close as I've come to being sort of completely mind rocked by a show.
I'd agree.
Since Law, that was pretty amazing.
Well, what was great about that too is with True Detective, it had a bit of that supernatural element, and kind of once all that Yellow King and stuff came out, then they started posting articles about it. It almost felt like it was getting back into the Lost game, where the amazing thing about Lost was just dissecting it and all the little Easter eggs and the books, and they talked about that and it relates to this, and people would read your articles about Lost, and we would do podcasts, and just there was message boards, and I don't know if that type of environment will happen again, because with streaming, I don't know if you have that window of time.
Right. Yeah, you guys still there?
Yeah. Can you hear us? Are we breaking up?
Yeah.
No, okay.
I think that, I totally agree that the streaming idea and sort of the Netflix sensations, we miss out on something there, that sort of that communal active watching and being able to talk about things week to week. And I know, for example, this weekend, a lot of my fellow superhero comic book fans are really kind of binging on Daredevil.
Yep.
And it sounds like, I haven't been able to watch it yet, but it sounds like a really cool show.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like we're missing out a little bit on a fun conversation that we could be having about it, because everyone is just sort of indulging it privately. And then all you really get in terms of cultural conversation about it is, okay, I just got done watching all 13, and man, that was great. You should watch it.
Yeah, you're missing out on
Or even worse, yeah. It's like, oh, I'm on episode 2, you're on episode 4. Well, I can't talk to you about what this is.
Right.
And by the time you get to there, I'm actually ahead 2 now, or behind
also,
1.
The worst part with that, too, is you have to stay off social media. Because
right.
I was like, okay, I can't go on Facebook, I can't go on Twitter, because someone's gonna spoil me on what happened on episode 4. So you just have,
right.
It's tough. I mean, I like the fact that you get to watch it all at once, but you're like you were saying earlier about Lost. I don't think it'll ever be. There'll never be another Lost. I just don't.
Or even if there was, caliber of Lost, I don't know if you'd still have that same.
You won't have, because
environment.
Look at people 10 years later. I mean, what, the ending was 5 years ago. And people are still geeked out
almost
over
5 years
it
ago, yeah.
Still want to talk about it. We do the panel every year, and I go, why don't we do something else? But every year, people come out, and all they want to talk about is Lost. So it's just a one-in-a-lifetime show.
Right. And, I've said before, and I still somewhat stand by this, but on the 10th anniversary of Lost, I celebrated the show, but at the same time, it kind of used it as my opportunity to lay out my big theory, which is that I'm not a big fan of rewatching shows.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really a big fan. I'm probably in the wrong business then. I'm not necessarily a big fan of putting things in a historical perspective and saying this is the greatest show ever or whatever. Mm-hmm. I tend to look at shows as very much things of their time and great stories of their time. That inform our times and keep us company in that times and give us conversation during that time. But when their time is over, I think to some degree we love continuing to talk about Lost, But I don't want to rewatch Lost. I want to watch, I want to invest in the show that is talking to us now about now, mm-hmm. you know? But with that said, you know, my kids are now old enough to watch Lost, and they do want to watch Lost. And I think it's super fun to watch Lost with them. And people are discovering this show over and over again. And what I've, a new generation of viewers are discovering this show. And what I get the sense is that they are very much having the same capture the imagination experience that we had, but mm-hmm. there's no conversation for them out there
yeah.
to be talking about, because they have all these ideas and they have their own theories too. And it's fascinating that, like, you know, even though they're consuming it differently than we did, they're still having largely that same kind of experience, and they're still thinking it through, and they have questions and ideas. And so, you know, like, you know, they tweet me like, where are your recaps? Or they tweet the other sort of Lost bloggers that have been out there, and like, where can I find your stuff? And like, you know, it kind of stinks for them that they don't have that conversation yeah. there for them. But with that said, the conversation still continues, and people still want to talk about the show. And I do think that's cool. I love having those conversations with people.
Yeah, it's nice to see it continue to live on and kind of engage people. To your point, the friends that I have or coworkers, because at work I'm the Lost guy. So if anybody's talking about, it's like, hey, you're that Lost guy, right?
Lost guy.
You're Lost guy. Hey, Lost guy, come over here and talk to me about the show. but it's fun to see them, you know, kind of go through it on Netflix or something like that. And but you're right, they don't have that same community that we had back then, you know, where you would post an article or Ryan and Jen post a podcast or you would join, you know, the Fuselage message boards and talk about it with your friends. And there isn't that. It's all out there. You can go see it and view it, but it's not a live conversation like it was back
right.
then.
You said your kids are watching it. Do they ever come up to you with theories and you kind of look at them and go, oh, if you only knew?
Oh, no, they don't watch. They're not watching it yet.
Oh, okay. Okay. You can make fun of them later
but,
on.
But they want to. right. But, you know, it's like they want me to spoil it for them. And it's like, okay, like they're very intrigued by it. But they, you know, and they're not really ready to sit down and watch it right now. But probably I would say within a year. But they want me to, like, you know, like, who is the guy with the, you know, orange frizzy hair who won the lotto? You know, and like, you know, they heard things. So, they want me to tell them the whole story, which, you know, part of me would really love to do that because I can.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
No, yeah, absolutely. And so with shows, let's see, you have Better Call Saul, you have this possible return of Full House.
I'm podcasting about that.
But what do you think there's something like that for Lost realistically? I mean, we can all talk about, you know, oh, you know, we can follow Hurley on the island with Walt. But is there something out there realistically like that that could continue the mythology? Because I feel like the fans are still there. But who would it be something that could be a real undertaking?
To sort of like give us more Lost in some form?
Yeah. Because it seems to be working for something like Better Call Saul, you know, hit show.
Yeah.
And it's exploring the universe kind of before the events
say,
that we
I
saw.
Say they go where they're introduced to an across the sea mother. Start with that.
Nah, it's too far back.
No,
I think.
I want to know how it started.
Fascinating. I think that if we were to drop into the Lost story somewhere and kind of tell kind of the story of Lost, I'd love to kind of know more about the Charles Widmore sort of era of ruling of the others on the island and their sort of conflict with the Dharma Initiative. Like, mm-hmm. I think that would be kind of where I would want to drop in. And of course, I think that there are, you know, I think that the story of Lost suggests that, you know, cycles and there are different periods of history. I think that I would love to see, like, if they ever rebooted Lost, and I think that we need to, I think we really need to open ourselves up to the possibility that somewhere down the road, you know, like, you know, 20 years, 10 years, you know, the ABC and the Walt Disney ABC Studios will think it's a good idea to bring Lost back. I would rather see a whole new group of characters land on that island, and I would love to see them, you know, investigate the history of the island, and in that way, kind of like maybe pick up some stories of some of the characters that we know by. But it needs to be about a whole new group of people. That's that. I really have mixed feelings about that prospect. I kind of feel like. Lost is very much the story that Damon and Carlton told, and I think they told their big Lost story. I wouldn't put it past those imaginations to very quickly come up with a new idea for a story that they really do sincerely believe in and would want to tell. But I honestly don't think that's their interest.
Mm-hmm.
So then I would have funny feelings about. Some other storyteller playing in that world. It would really, unlike, say, kind of like the promise of more X-Files, which we have Chris Carter, David Duchovny, and Gillian Anderson working together, or the prospect for Twin Peaks, which now, of course, is in jeopardy because we don't know if David Lynch is really going to direct it.
Yeah.
I mean, those stories will be rebooted with their storytellers in place. And I think with the X-Files is a kind of franchise where you could keep on telling stories forever and ever with that world. Twin Peaks, maybe not so much. With Lost, I just kind of feel like the characters, you know, those castaways, like, we got their story.
Yeah.
I'm satisfied with their story. I would want a new story, but I would feel weird if, like, the original storytellers don't tell it. So I have mixed feelings about the prospect.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And it seems like, you know, Damon and Carlton have closed that chapter completely and don't want to go back to it. So you're right. It'd be tough in a sense that it more than likely, if it did happen, it would be, you know, different storytellers, or you'd have to wait long enough to where Darlton would, you know, be okay revisiting if ever. But, you know, it's an interesting fact, because I meant to bring up the X-Files thing too, you know, for all the X-Files fans, and you could argue X-Files was kind of the show that was that kind of show before Lost, in that era of the 90s. But, it's just an interesting idea that, that universe still exists out there. There's a lot of stories that could still be told, but would you want it to be told if it wasn't the people that created it and made it such a big hit before? Have you read Javier Griot, Mark Swatch, insanely long essay about his time at Lost?
Yeah, I thought that was a great contribution to the Lost lore and to our understanding of how they made that show. And I think that for anyone that had the patience to read all of it, and I don't know how you wouldn't have the patience for it, because it was just like one great anecdote after another. I think that you know, I thought it was great insight to that show, and a great insight into how shows in general work, but how this special one worked,
mm-hmm.
and kind of really have like answered definitively the issue of the master plan.
Yeah.
Which I think that, like, one of his great points of it, of that essay, is that that the whole idea of master planning and is a really reductive way to talk about any television show, and impossible. I mean, like shows just don't work that way. Any show, like, you wish they would, but they really can't. But with that said, it is impressive the degree to which they had not necessarily things figured out, but a real sort of strong sense of vision of how to operate the show.
Mm-hmm.
And how it's a great story of how things are discovered along the way.
Yeah.
That was a great read.
Yeah, it was. And I really liked, and to me, I felt like it kind of showed that it on one hand had a master plan, on the other, it had to be a living, breathing entity that kind of grew and evolved as things went along, just based upon the fact that it was a broadcast show. But I think it answered some point during it's like, was it thought out before, you know, and all planned? Yes. And was it kind of made up as it went along? Yes. And
right.
I just thought that was
all things are true.
Yeah, exactly. And I really liked
that aspect. I don't understand why people get upset with the fact that it did have parts that were made up as it went along. I mean, you have people that just get so upset by that. And I don't understand why.
I think that criticism of making it up all, as they went along, or you know, the discussion of a master plan has become this shorthand in the way that we talk about a certain kind of dissatisfaction with Lost, which is, you know, definitely among those kind of people that really wanted it to be a story that, like, that made perfect sense for, you know, looking backward or revealed all of the answers to all of the mysteries and all of the questions that you always ever had. And so, we could talk forever and ever about whether or not that's a fair criticism of Lost, about whether or not it needed to pay out quote unquote answers and to which questions. What I totally allow is that there were people who watched the show with those questions and with those concerns,
mm-hmm.
and they really hope that we would get kind of like clear or at least more compelling answers to certain questions, and they weren't satisfied. And I don't think that they were ever wrong to have those questions or want those answers. The show put that stuff out there for us to be engaged by, and to kind of like say, "Well, was it really about that all?" I have sympathy for that. That's not where I stand. But for those people, then, like, they're left with a dissatisfaction that they're trying to rationalize.
Yeah.
They're trying to understand how we didn't get what we thought we were going to get. And so one logical explanation for that possible answer is that, well, they just didn't have the answers. Ergo, they really didn't know what they were doing. They were just making it up as long, you know?
Yeah.
So like, I think that debate is really part and parcel of a larger sort of like, figuring out of our fellow Lost fans who were equally obsessed and equally interested as us, but weren't satisfied, and they're trying to figure out why. And
yeah.
That's the narrative that gets produced as a result of that.
Yeah, and it's interesting. And one thing I did like about it was it showed, you know, JJ wanted that hatch like episode 2. But Damon didn't want to put it in until they had an answer for it. And I think it showed that throughout all of it, no matter if it was not every single thing was dictated before the second episode was ever aired, it showed that they did care about posing questions and making sure that there was answers to those questions. I thought that was a nice piece to include in there.
You couldn't have the hatch in the second episode because
yeah.
you wouldn't want Locke going crazy on the second episode.
Yeah.
What
I thought was really, you know, some of the things that I really kind of glommed onto on that essay, which, you know, some things I've heard before, some things I haven't, but, you know, what I thought was interesting is that how from the get-go, Damon always envisioned a show where the island was basically this cosmic battleground for a battle between good
yeah.
and evil.
Yep.
That said, I think what's insightful is that whatever, like, that the monster from the beginning, like, it doesn't necessarily appear that the monster was originally part of that conception of the monster was something separate, or basically they just had no idea really what it was. And so, yeah, it was like, I want the island to ultimately be this battleground for a place between good and evil, but we also have this smoke monster. Yeah. And it really didn't seem until like second, third, fourth season brainstorming, evolving process to say, hey, maybe the monster can have something to do and bring to life this other part of the show that we've always been galvanized by.
Mm-hmm.
I thought what was really interesting about that essay that he wrote was it sounded like that was one area that Damon was most concerned about all the way through, even though that there were a lot of pitches about what that thing could be. He rarely wanted to show it because he wasn't yet committed to what it was going to be. And so I thought that was an interesting insight that kind of explained the sporadic appearances of the monster in the first three seasons and how its properties and aspects were very carefully and doled out. And it was clear because it seemed to be the insight there is that they wanted to be very careful about, doing something until they completely figured out what that was going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And, it'll be interesting, and maybe Javi's only ever do it, but it'd be interesting to see other perspectives too. Who knows if it ever happened, and who could ever have the stamina to write, the 200,000 word, essay, that read, but it was a really nice piece, and I'd love to talk to him more about it. But it was really cool, a nice addition to the show. You talked about True Detective. What do you think about the new cast? And because they just released a trailer for season two with Vince Vaughn and Colin Farrell. What did you think of that trailer? Did it get you excited or get you worried that is it going to match what season one was?
I think that we should just be worried about that anyway, because it's a whole new cast, whole new story. And it should be different,
Yeah.
It's kind of a no-brainer in the sense of like, it's hard to be too excited about it because it's like a totally unknown quantity, and it's, totally natural to be anxious about it because like people satisfy. I don't really connect with the some of the knee jerk, snarky kind of like let's make fun of Vince Vaughn kind of aspect of the whole thing.
Yeah.
If anything, in that sort of like 1 minute long, very evocative like succession of images, I saw a Vince Vaughn in there that's a very compelling performance. Mm-hmm. I think he plays a mobster of some kind in this show, and that might not be a role that we expect to see from him, but it looked like he could pull it off.
Yeah.
It looked like that he generates some kind of like a presence that I think could be very compelling. So. I definitely get this vibe from some corners of the internet and Twitter and critics that the Vince Vaughn of it all is a polarizing aspect. But I'm not one of those guys, so I'm looking forward to it. I hope it's engaging at the first.
Yeah, and I'm not going to be one of those people that are snarky about it. I think he can and is a good actor and can really kind of prove those critics wrong in this show. I think he's gonna have a good shot.
Rudy, so
there you go. Oh, man. All right, Jeff, we're kind of closing up on our hour here. Really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Again, exciting time for you right now with Tomorrow coming up and the book being released. Anything, do you want to take this moment to kind of plug it and tell people where they can find and read this book? I bought it on Amazon Prime so I could read it on my Apple mobile devices. But do you want to plug out there?
Well, I think you can find it pretty easily online, and it's rolling out in stores like Barnes & Noble. But in my final minutes, I would love to just say to you guys, thanks for continuing to do this. I've said this before, I think, the other time I was on the show, but I think this is a beautiful thing that you guys do. You've built a great community. And it's this wonderful a place where lost fandom is alive, but sort of like this really wonderful flashpoint for pop culture fandom, and how you're kind of leveraging your geekiness and your community to kind of like raise funds for this is like, I think it's just really cool. I think you're doing a really good thing out there. So thank you for doing
that. Well, I appreciate that. Yes. That's very, very kind words. Very appreciated.
We just talk. We don't do any of the work.
Well, cool, guys. Well, it's great to talk with you.
Absolutely. It's good to talk with you. And will you be at Comic-Con this year?
I hope to be kicking around there. Yes. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, we'll be there. So if we see you, say hi.
Don't George Clooney us.
I won't. I promise.
Oh, man. All right. Well, Jeff, thank you so much. Give Jeff a round of applause. Woo! Jeff Jensen, Lost Rider EW. And
cool. Take care, guys. Bye-bye. All right.
Bye.